I'm John Barrett Ingalls, and this is The How, The Why. Presented by 1888. Every week, we connect with artists, authors, and innovators in the world of publishing and literature to discuss their creative process and creative purpose, and explore the evolution of the industry. 1888 serves as a regional catalyst for the preservation, presentation, and promotion of cultural heritage and literary arts. Let's get connected.
Hello, and welcome to The How, The Why, brought to you by 1888. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with Amy Bender, author of multiple books and stories, but in particular, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, and the most recent, The Color Master. Amy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it is definitely my pleasure. So let's talk about the life of literature in you, in your head, and at what age you started to see the power of storytelling and the written word, and at what age you started to practice it yourself.
I think early it felt very fluid. I loved reading, and I had an elementary school that was really good at supporting writing. So we had lots of writing assignments, and I remember enjoying it so much and liking stories and liking words, just enjoying words as things. And I think there was a natural trajectory happening, and then there was kind of a long dip once adolescent hit, where I backed away from it, or I felt maybe less of a clear avenue for me to keep going with. So writing something, if I had been asked at 7, I would have completely said I wanted to be a writer. But if I had been asked at 17, I would have never dared. So by 27, maybe I was back again. But it was like in these dips and hills and valleys. But I always really liked reading, and I liked rereading. I did a lot of rereading of books that I loved as a kid, and I think that did, I absorbed a lot of things that way.
Sure, yeah. I have a very difficult time. There's only been a handful of books that I've been able to reread, and I just feel like, well, there's not enough time. There's so many other things, but definitely on the rereading, it enters into your bones and into your flesh, and it becomes a part of you.
Exactly. And I always feel like there's not enough time to read all of it one time. You get to pick the things that you do want to be part of your bones, and some of those do really are worth rereading, I think.
So was it in school that you saw, in undergrad, that you saw, well, I think that this is something that I want to pursue? Or
not even undergrad for me. I mean, I went to undergrad and started as a theater major and was pretty unsure what I wanted, and liked theater and was doing playwriting. And I have a sister who writes, so I was also, I think, figuring that she was kind of the writer of the family, so I should do something else. So I was kind of tiptoeing around and avoiding fiction and taking workshops and really liking the workshops, but just in a muddle. And it wasn't even until, I guess, after college, I was still taking classes and still writing. It's funny, in retrospect, it was a clear through line, but at the time, it didn't at all feel like that. It felt like it's a very confused, muddled time. And then when I went to get an MFA, I couldn't even say to myself then that I was getting an MFA because I wanted to be a writer. It was much more, I was getting an MFA because I wanted an MFA, because I felt so jealous of friends that were getting MFAs. It seemed like the coolest thing to get. So it wasn't until deep in the MFA, when I'm working every day and I'm surrounded by writers, that I could kind of let the tiniest admission to myself that maybe that was something I wanted to do.
That's funny you brought up that your sister's a writer, and you kind of,
yeah.
It's weird how we assign those roles, and we, it's like a non-committal yeah. agreement that we make. Well, that friend is the this, so I can't do that.
Yeah.
Or that relative does that, and they have that cornered, that market cornered.
Yeah, it's kind of this invented rule system, but I can see as a kid, like musical instruments, I was sort of trying to find, I did clarinet because my other sisters were doing string instruments, and it was just like, I need to find a territory that's all mine, even though, you know, my sister, I really love her writing, and her writing is really different than mine, and we're obviously different people. Like, the territory thing, I think, is pretty made up, but it's
sure.
very convincing when you're a kid, yeah.
Yeah. So then in the MFA,
yeah.
You
yeah.
started embracing it, and at what point were you sending work out to get published?
I started sending work out after college, actually. So I had about 4 years between undergrad and grad, and I'd been sending work out that whole time, getting mostly rejections and I think one acceptance in those 4 years, and that was that was a good moment. And then, when I was in grad school, I was sending out still really regularly. And it was like the olden days, right, where you would send envelopes with stamps and get back envelopes with little slips of paper in them. So it really these days feels so like it was 1902 or something because I still have somewhere a file full of all these tiny slips of paper, most of which were generic, just saying, you know, thank you for
thank
your submission,
you.
But not for
yeah.
us. And then it was almost like something just shifted. I started to write more in a way that I think felt like it was more my own, and slowly publications started to happen. And then when enough publications happened, I got an agent, and then the agent sold the book. And like it just, there was kind of suddenly a momentum that just shifted things. And that's when that changed.
So The Girl in the Flammable Skirt, the first book, a series of stories. At what moment in the writing of those stories were you aware that they were all going to be a collection?
I had been writing stories for years, so I would sort of enjoy pretending they were a collection and kind of gathering them together in my mind and picturing them as a collection. And then I had this interesting way where as I worked harder and the stories shifted and got better, then the previous stories would sort of fall away. So it was like this, I don't know how to describe it, almost like a rolling ball or something where all the stories keep falling away and the ball keeps shifting until finally there was a collection that did become The Girl in the Flammable Skirt. And it really did feel different because suddenly the stories felt more of a piece, and they felt more connected to each other, and they just felt like they had a similar-ish voice, and I could kind of feel that. So it was, and that was an exciting moment because it's sort of something kind of gelled in a way that hadn't before, even though I kept sort of imagining, oh, this will be in my collection, and then I'd realize, no, that story is, I wrote that 5 years ago, and that story doesn't hold up at all anymore, and so that's how that kind of worked.
Was there a temptation to attempt something longer, or you knew that it was going to be short stories?
Yeah, I for the longest time I didn't feel like trying anything longer, and my short stories were really short for short stories too. They were like 6 pages. And when I first sold the book, it was a 2-book sale, and the editor initially said, why don't you write a novel? And I had started a novel, but I didn't know if I would ever finish it or if it would work. And they said, so we love this collection, but why don't you finish the novel and that'll come out first? And I couldn't kind of do that. It just didn't make sense. So I talked it over with my agent, and we said, well, the stories have to come out first. And then they went for that, which was great because I just needed time to kind of muck around in the novel, and also the stories were ready. They were really ready, and it was a really good time for those stories to come out then. So,
are you pretty aware when you start writing that this is something that is, you know, has this briefness to it, or it's a short story, or Are you surprised sometimes by like how much more you want to continue writing it?
No, it's for me, they do kind of arrive in a different shape or something, so that a story has a different drive and a different push inside it, and the sentences, they close down more, they can be a little more sweeping, and a novel's all about opening up and reopening up and opening up again and opening up into scene and opening up into the past and whatever, so it has a very different feeling to me. And it has to in order to keep going. So I know some people have the experience of having a short story that then develops into a novel. But that hasn't happened for me. They've always been distinct.
Are you somebody who, like if you was an invisible sign of my own or the particular sadness of Lemon Cake, are you somebody who outlines the entire thing and approaches it in that kind of traditional style, or do you just write? And then do you do the same thing for short stories?
When I first started writing Invisible Sign, I'd never written a novel before and I wasn't sure. And I thought about kind of outlining and I would make decisions about where it was going. And it was so wrong. Like it was so unhelpful to me. Because short stories have always been kind of a wander and then it's done and
sure.
Surprise, you know, the surprise being the most enjoyable part really for me. And so that's been my approach to novels. But with novels, it's unbelievable how much wandering I have to do to kind of find the novel. So they're not planned and they're not outlined, but there's just hundreds and hundreds of pages that get cut. And I'm working on a novel now and it's the same thing where I just have like, I can just feel that I'm trying to find something, I'm trying to unearth something, but I haven't found it yet, so I have to kind of keep writing to it or around it, and then eventually I get there. And, you know, the work that I do has value in that I'm practicing the act of writing, but it won't actually show up in the final book.
Where do some of your ideas come from? Are you somebody who is just constantly jotting down, like, oh, that would be interesting? Because they're so fantastical, a lot of them. Is it like, I wonder if this thing happened, or, you know, what if this person had that going on with them?
Actually, they're not jotted down. And I know, there's a book, Bird by Bird, by Anne Lamott, which is a great book on writing. And she talks about index cards and writers carrying around index cards so you can jot things down. And I always kind of liked that idea. But I think what happened with me was sort of the opposite, which was when I was in grad school, I started writing kind of at a fixed time during the day, every day, or 6 days a week then. And it was not a long time, but I would just sit and do my work then, or just sit there. And it had this effect of making the rest of the day kind of free and clear of writing, which was really helpful.
Hmm.
So jotting down would kind of feel intrusive in the rest of
sure.
the day. It would feel like, I don't want to be thinking about writing. My job right now is actually to be forgetting about writing so that I can sit down in the morning and see what bubbles up. And let's say 10 ideas might bubble up one morning and zero the next three mornings. And of those 10 ideas, maybe one would have some engine to it. And so it's very rare that I've had an idea during the day that then carries through. It's so common that I'll have an idea and get all excited about it, and it's nothing. So to the point where I've now kind of disregarded ideas.
Are there ever like ideas that come up like, oh, this would be great, and then you forget about it and like, what was that one idea like 2 weeks ago? I remember, are there moments where you're like, I wish I would have written that down?
Well, no, this is what's really interesting about the mind, I think. Yes, those moments happen, and I'll think, what was that idea? And I think initially I would feel worried, like, that was my idea, that was my great idea, and it's over now. And then you realize they totally come back. They come back
sure.
a little different, but they come back because we human people, you know, I feel like are so circular in our preoccupations, and I feel like whatever is the pool of material that I dip into to write from has certain things in it, and those certain things keep coming back up, and I keep writing about them in slightly different ways or radically different ways or whatever, but it's not like the idea comes up once and then it's gone. It's just never happened to the point where even entire books feel like connected to a previous book. Like I'll just see certain ideas surface again and again, but in new ways. So it's actually really relieving to feel that. Like you can just let them go. It's like meditating where they're like, you have to see the thought and let it go.
Let it go.
It feels like there's the idea and let it go, because if it has enough juice in it, it will totally return.
Yeah, what is that saying? If you love it, let it go,
right.
It returns, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's nice too. That's nice too, exactly.
I always think of this is so silly. I think of this sketch, what was it from? I think it was from Upright Citizens Brigade or something, and it was this guy had loved his toothbrush, and he sent his toothbrush away. And, you know, and it was that saying, if you love it, let it go. And then eventually the toothbrush came back with a thing.
Oh,
it was really funny.
That's great. And it's like totally grimy. It's not like you really want your toothbrush to come back.
A lot of your stories have this in your book as well. There's this really personal feeling of relationships. And I'm just curious for you as a writer, how you handle with people or family members or people that you have relationships with asking, well, is this supposed to be me?
Mm-hmm.
Because you do such a great job of creating these relationships that are not necessarily the perfect relationship, but I don't think any are in life.
Right.
I had a book that my mom won't even read because she's afraid of what I think of her in the book, you know, for whatever reason.
Because she won't even read it.
Well, but mine's a memoir, so this is more like a direct connection.
Right.
But how do you, have you dealt with that? Or do you have people in your life who are like, oh, was that supposed to be me? Is that what you think of me?
I mean, I think for the most part, I've been able to kind of skate under the radar with the magical element, because when things get transformed, it does, I think, put people away from seeing themselves in it a little bit. And I think it helps me. Like, part of the reason I think I'm drawn to disguising things, and not like I know what I'm disguising, but I'm disguising something to myself so that I can try to write about it more truthfully, say, because like I'm not self-conscious about who it looks like or whatever, because it's a salamander or whatever, you know, so like so that's very freeing for me. But generally because of that, I think it hasn't happened. Or if it's about a family, there's so much inside the family that's then focused on the particular strangenesses of the family members that are different than reality strangenesses, and that helps me also look away from the reality that's hopefully building alongside it. So that's been okay. I mean, I think I remember once two different guys that I dated thought they were there's a devolving boyfriend in a story, and two people were sure that it was them, and you know, and I hadn't been thinking specifically of either of them. So it was, but it's like a classic breakup story in a way. So you know, I had been through a breakup. So.
You're so vain, you probably think this song is about you. I'm also curious as how you approach in the particular sadness of Lemon Cake. You travel about a little over a decade of time from the point of view of a character starting at 8, 9 years old and then going into young adult life. How did you handle the passage of time from point of view?
I mean, it's interesting because it's been nice when people have said that they feel her kind of changing in age over the course of the book, because it was not that intentional on my part. I think what I wanted is, I imagined that she was looking back to some degree, but then in the scenes and in the moments, I guess, maybe I would just get involved in the scene with a kid from that age. So it was sort of like, in my mind, looking back and also being in the moment of that age at the same time. So it was kind of both at the same time, but it wasn't, I think if I had really taken that in as an issue, it would have been really confusing for me to manage. Like, how do I handle that point of view? So some of it was just trying it out and hoping that a reader would follow along with whatever I was trying, not even really knowing what that was.
Yeah, it was something that I picked up on too. Of like, oh, this is her voice as a teenager, which is completely different, but yet with that same, you know, it's still the same person, but just through this different lens. I was just curious. Now I read. I read one of your short stories, The Origin Lessons, which I loved.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I'm curious, and this is not necessarily writing, but just because you do write in fantastic realism, what do you think we are? It's a big question.
I like the question. It's not like I can really answer convincingly, but we meaning people or we in that story? Oh,
we as in we as people. What do you think we are?
What are we?
World in this thing. You.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's of course not an easy answer.
No.
yeah.
Put you on the spot. Come on.
Yeah.
What do you got? Come on. Give me your philosophy on life.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I just think it's just amazing that we are aware of our experience as we're having it. So whatever, we're just these little vessels of consciousness, but that it's, I think that, or even the fact that we're aware that we die seems like such a marker of humanness and such a big, big deal.
So we have a concept of a somewhat beginning and somewhat of an end.
Yeah, that we're able to kind of take that in, and I have little kids now, and just watching kind of the human being develop through them we're like an incredible species. We're so capable. And at the same time, I heard once humans described as a kind of weed, and I think that's accurate too. That there's certain I wish I could credit the thinker, but that they were saying, you know, there's weeds we think of in the garden, and then there are weeds that are creatures like pigeons are totally weeds. They just kind of get along wherever, and squirrels are kind of weeds, and I think humans also. So, you know, a friend of mine described us recently as a virus. So, I mean, it's all sort of kind of bad ways that we are, but we're just
sure.
We're also these quite incredible experiments, I think.
Yeah, if you take away our outward expression and just see that inward, whatever the multiverse of the brain.
So incredible.
Now, as AC, you teach at USC, you teach creative writing. How does the teaching aspect influence the way that you write?
The teaching part, I've been teaching for years, pretty much as long as I've been writing seriously. I've been teaching because before I went to get an MFA, I taught elementary school, which was really fun. But I think I've always just felt it's more of a, it's like a balance of how to be in the world. There are writers who can write all day long and like that sort of pristine space to work and think. But I like a much shorter time to get my writing done. And for years it was 2 hours, and now it's a little bit less. But it's just wanting to kind of go in, get the work done, and be done. And like I was saying before, then have the rest of the day liberated from thinking about writing. So teaching, even though I'm talking about writing and reading student work, it's so different than mucking around in my unconscious thinking of, you know, in this wandering state and exploring and all that. That's such a very different state of mind than being up in front of a classroom and talking about setting, you know, or talking about similes or whatever, which is really fun, and talking to the students about what they're thinking about writing or like what we're doing right now. I really enjoy it, but it's in no way the same creature as writing. So for me, that is a nice balance. I like people. I like talking to people. So if I was an expert in car mechanics, I would enjoy teaching car mechanics, but I can't do that at all. So writing is something I know a little bit about, so I can get up in front of people and do that. But I think the other thing about teaching that's fun is that every teacher shows up in front of a classroom, whether they know it or not, you show up with a kind of moral code about what you're talking about. And I think mine returns again and again to something about what's the best way to put it? That there's too much rigidity in the thinking about fiction, and that fiction has a lot of space to do so many things, and that there's so many pieces of writing that break boundaries in incredible ways, and that's really exciting for me to talk about, and it's a reminder for me when I sit down to play and to explore and to not feel bound by really anything. I mean, fiction can do so much. There's no budget. There's no, you can play with how the page looks. You can character and plot. Those are flexible ideas. So, and there's so many books that do things in interesting ways. I just read a short novel called Brief is a Thing with Feathers, and it's just like this very short novel about loss, but it's just done in this, it sort of feels a little bit like poetry and a little bit like a novel and a little bit like dialogues, and it's just exciting to see that kind of thing.
When you sit down to work in whatever time you allot yourself, do you tell yourself that you have to focus on one project, or do you allow yourself to do a little on one story and then maybe take a break? Do you have to write something to completion before you start something else?
No, and vehemently the opposite, in that I think writing something to completion is baloney in my book, in that if you put in time, eventually things will complete, but you don't necessarily know which ones. And my strong belief is that the thing that needs to be really firm is the structure, at least for me, the structure of time. And for everyone, different, but for me, there has to be a really, really firm structure of time. So like, let's say it's 40 minutes, and I'm going to sit and write for 40 minutes, and I'm going to stay there for 40 minutes. What happens within that 40 minutes is completely open. So I can work on many things. I don't have to work on anything. I could work on one thing. That's all about the roaming of the mind within that space, but the firmness comes from the time structure. Or some people will do a page count or a word count, or some people will do something else. But for me, you can't have both things be loose. Mm. If both things are loose, it's just unpleasant. But I can really trust and lean on that box of time, and then, yeah, I'll work on 10 things at once. I'll work on a bunch of things. I'll work on nothing. I'll work on one thing. Whatever. And then I feel like once that kind of goal has been set and I've completed that time, that's the completion. And this comes up at readings and stuff where people will say, well, what if it's going well? Do you stop? But I do always stop. And like Hemingway had this great theory of stopping in the middle of a sentence so that when you return the next day, you're totally engaged.
Right. You know where it's going. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's again on this idea of a kind of, it's the same thing as not writing down the idea and trusting it'll come back. Like just banking on the abundance of material inside a person. Going back to what are we? We certainly carry around a buttload of stuff inside ourselves. And if you just give it a little space to bubble up, stuff will bubble up. And for your whole life, that can happen. It's just, how do you create structures that allow that to happen?
Well, Amy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me and share all your wonderful ideas, and it was a lot of fun.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun for me. Thanks for having me.
This has been The How, The Why with John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The How, The Why theme music was composed and performed by Dan Record. Please consider supporting 1888 and our mission. Become an 1888 advocate by purchasing our books, participating in our programs, and pledging today. For more information, visit 1888.center. That's 1-888-DOT-CENTER. I want to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.